From the land of Grand University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason out of the office today. So no update of the commodity markets. However, we will hear today from the Farm Assets Conference. Our first session came to us remotely from Ukraine and Brazil. We begin with Roman Gorobets. He is a farmer in Ukraine and explained to us about his operation and how things have changed during the war with Russia. And then we'll turn our attention to Joanna Colucci, who is in Brazil and has an update on South American crop prospects and other things that will be impacting the marketplace.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Good morning, or good 5 o'clock in the evening to you, Roman. Thank you for being with us. I appreciate it. Roman Gorobets is a farmer in Ukraine. And Roman, if you could bring up, we've got a little bit of an introduction to you, but I want you to tell us a little bit about yourself, and you can bring up your presentation at this point, and then talk a little bit about where you live and farm, and then we'll have just a quick discussion about what it's like to farm in the midst of a war zone. So good morning to you, Roman, or good Friday evening, as it may be.
Yes, it is indeed an evening in Ukraine. It's 5:08 p.m. So, and a lot of my friends are either on their way back home or to the bar. So I hope I'll join them. I am a farmer, but not like a regular American style farmer, because in Ukraine we basically manage other people, or we manage agribusiness facilities. So let me tell you about my business and what I do. But before that, I'll tell several sentences about myself. So I am Roman. I'm 38 years old. Graduated from Agrarian State University in Ukraine 15 years ago. And I also have a degree, MBA degree from Suffolk University in Boston. Both of my degrees are in economics and finance, but also I have some good knowledge about agricultural processes, agronomy, how machinery works, and stuff like that. So about my farm. So basically what I'm trying to show you is, this is the map of Ukraine. I hope most of you are familiar with that. And this circle is where I live and where my operation are taking place.
Because you're not seeing the maps, I'll tell you that his farm is to the southeast of Kyiv and on the north side of the Dnieper River.
We have around 5,500 acres, and we plant corn, soybeans, wheat, barley, sometimes canola. And then for the next year, we decided to plant a little bit of sugar beet because we anticipate a good margin on that. In terms of equipment, we have three big tractors, five small tractors, two planters, and two small grain seeders. We also have three combines. Actually, one we just purchased 3 months ago. And we also have a grain storage facility for around 400,000 bushels of corn. We also have some poultry. It's about 10,000 chicks per year. We also grow some vegetables and sweet corn. It's only 10 acres. It's not that big. We also have a small apple orchard, and we produce apple juice. It's around 2,500 gallons a year. So for all of that, we employ 55 full and part-time workers. So you just brought a question recently. Our yield for corn on average It's around 160 bushels per acre, but this year we managed to get roughly around 180 something. For soybeans, on average, it's 45, and for wheat, it's around 90. The biggest deficiency we have in our area, it's moisture. Not the moisture itself, but uneven distribution of moisture. Because we can have very wet May and very dry July and August. So August basically is the driest month, and the second part of July as well. So basically, if you don't have enough moisture during the end of July and the beginning of August, your corn is not going to perform well, and that's for sure. In 2020, we got our corn yield was below 80, and it was bad. It was a really bad situation. But due to time, due to price, we did manage to maintain some very small margin. I think that's pretty it about my operation. Do you have any more questions?
Well, if you want to go on through the rest of your presentation and talk a little bit about what it's like to be in the midst of a war zone, that would be good too. I know you've got a couple of photos and maybe some ideas of where the export facilities are. I can ask you about those. I know those are coming up because you and I think your brother, prior to the invasion, recognized, is this correct, that the war was going to come? The invasion happened when? In March. The previous fall, you purchased all your inputs and put them on the farm, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. A lot of foreign intelligence, they were telling Ukrainians, Ukrainian government, Ukrainian president, like, look, guys, there are a huge threat at your border, and you need to consider it, and you need to take proper actions. Unfortunately, our government, they were trying to calm everything down and try to reassure everybody. Nothing is going to happen. It's just, we can deal with that. But we took it seriously, and we purchased all of the... We didn't want to leave, first of all, because if we left, it would be like we surrender, because we gave everything up to invaders. So we decided, okay, we're going to stay, and we're going to maintain our operation. And we decided to put all of the to purchase all of the inputs, so that's what we did. We sold majority of our grain, and we purchased all of the fuel, all of the fertilizers, seeds, chemicals. So we were good for up to harvest season, and we didn't face any troubles with getting fuel during April and May, because in April and May it was very hard to get fuel. All of our supply chains were disrupted, and Ukrainian farmers and all of the Ukraine, they wanted to reestablish new supply chains from Europe, from other sources. So we didn't face those difficulties, and we were good. And we were lucky enough that our area, Russians, they just didn't get to.
Your marketing prior to the war was like what? How did you go about marketing, and what did you do to move grain?
I think it's better to show the map.
Okay.
Blue and green squares are deep sea ports. So three of them are near Odessa. These ports can handle Panamax type vessels. Mykolaiv can handle Handysize vessels, but it can be also reloaded to Panamax vessels. So basically, this is the these are main ports. Almost 80% of all Ukrainian grains are going through.
He's showing the ports on the Black Sea on the southern coast of Ukraine.
So those ports were shut down because of the invasion. And we couldn't sell our grain, and we needed to take it to western borders, to Poland, Slovak Republic, Hungary, or Romania up here. But we also had these three ports. This river, Danube River. It's one of the biggest river in Europe, by the way. And we have three ports up here. So basically, we started to use these three ports. They were quite redundant, but right now they are working in full capacity. I would say in 120% capacity. And we did, actually last year, we did manage to export through those three ports, I think around 30 million tons of grain. So, but this circle is where Constanța is located. It's the biggest port of Romania. So before war started, we had Black Sea region prices. Prices in, let's say, for corn in Romania, in Constanța, and in Odessa, they were pretty much the same.
Now here comes, this is the important part. This is how the cash price changed for the farmer, for Roman Gorobots in this case, who lives to the southwest of Kiev, and how much money he's actually able to garner for a bushel of, in this case, corn.
So my basis for delivering from my place to these three ports was around 75 cents per bushel. Let's say on average, the corn price is $5.5 a bushel, and my base is 75 cents. So I end up with $4.75 per bushel at my location. It's okay, because, you know, 5.5, it's a little bit more than US prices, let's say Chicago prices, because Black Sea region is more favorable due to proximity to Middle East region, North Africa region, and also to European Union consumers. So that's why our base is, if we compare Black Sea region and Chicago, it's a little bit higher. I mean, our price is a little bit higher. So what has changed? Those three ports shut down, and my bases from my place to these three ports in the Danube River increased to $2.5 a bushel, from 75 to 2.5. But there is also a basis up here between Constanța and the Danube ports, which is around $1. So $5.5 a bushel price for corn in Constanța, and I need to subtract $1 plus $3.5, and I end up with $2 per bushel of corn, which is, considering last year skyrocketed prices for fertilizers, it's around break-even or sometimes less.
For comparison's sake here, and I do not know what cost Roman was using, appears that the farmer in the United States would be losing at that price, $2 a bushel, something between 70 and at least $1.70 a bushel, maybe much more than that.
So it was quite difficult to operate under these circumstances. Fortunately, when Grain Initiative took place, these three ports of Odessa started to operate. So my basis dropped by $1. You know, it was easier because you have $1 in your pocket because of basis. Unfortunately, this spring, Grain Initiative ended, or I would say fortunately, because you know, it was a very bad situation, and all of those Russian surveyors, they were doing everything to slow our export down. To, you know, they were not doing good. So that's why at the beginning of August, I think this year, we started to export through these three ports, because we got some very good air defense systems. So Russian rockets, Russian drones, they, in 99% of cases, they cannot reach these three ports. So if we compare bases in September and bases in right now, so bases in September also dropped by around $1. So basically, we had, if we take under consideration $5.5 per bushel price, it used to be $2 up here in September. Right now, it's around $3.5, something like that.
And you would contribute that to the missile defense system, the Patriot missile defense system that came from the United States?
Not only Patriots. Of course, there are Patriot systems, but also the several systems from European Union suppliers. They are as good as Patriots. But of course, Patriots are doing an exceptional job.
It's exceptional just to talk about a defense system having that big of an impact on your bottom line. Is interesting to me. You also market locally as well, if I remember correctly.
So this is how it used to be before war. Before war, majority of our grain, we just exported directly. We were using export contracts in US dollars, so we could hedge our currency fluctuations. But right now, we mostly sell to our local consumers, because during these 660 days of big war, we did manage to establish very good connections with hog producers, with some oil extraction facilities, speaking about sunflower and soybeans, and also some bakeries and some mills. So we can sell our wheat with a quite good margin. We can sell our corn. Of course, we are for corn, we are using arbitrage. So we are calculating the basis and the price we have up here at our facility. So we can negotiate the price with the hog producer depending on what we have as alternative if we deliver our grain to Odessa ports and then it goes abroad. So basically, in terms of prices, it's almost the same, but there is a very important thing. If I take my grain to Odessa ports and export it directly, I need to wait around 60 days to be paid. But if I sell to local producer, to local consumer, I receive my payment within 3 days. And that's very important because, you know, cost of money and time and access to all of this liquidity.
The first time you and I talked on the radio, it was later for you, 9 or 10 o'clock at night, and you stopped me in the middle of our conversation. We were on Skype, and I couldn't, I generally work off audio, so we didn't have video, but you stopped me and asked me if I could hear the air raid signals. You were really nonchalant about that, and that there was an air raid going on. You weren't worried at that point. That was very early in the war. I know there are some, you're from your farm to the east, and you maybe can run your pointer along where the primary war zones are that farmers are working in. And I know you talk to them. What kind of conditions are they working under today?
That's a very good question. And I was about to show you some pictures. So that's what our farmers get during their operation season. These tractors, combines, sprayers, they exploded because of mines. And also one of the big problem is debris from rockets and Iranian drones. And those debris you need to collect. Actually, several pictures are mine up here from our fields. So we don't get, fortunately, we don't get mines because we haven't had any Russians on our soil, but we do have debris. Okay, this is the map from our authority. And if you take a look, orange is where the war used to be. So in orange, majority of this area is heavily mined, especially here in the south part of Ukraine, because this part is deliberated, this part, and also Kharkiv region, this part is deliberated as well, I think, to this side. So farmers in these areas, they are facing, and also north of Kyiv, they are also facing a lot of troubles with mines. One friend of mine who lives just like 10 miles away from me, he used to have his operations here, north of Kyiv. And he just abandoned that place because most of his fields over there were mined, heavily mined. And he said, okay, it's impossible to operate and I need to give it up. However, our forces, they are using military equipment to get rid of mines, something like this, like tanks and stuff. And also,
these are, you said forces, but you meant your farm, that farmers are using this equipment, right? Not the military.
Actually, military, they are using this equipment.
Okay.
At the right top corner. But also our biggest fund, United 24, they started to purchase or to develop these machineries to demine. Bottom left corner. But farmers, they are getting creative and they start to build their own equipment. It's something like this. Actually, this left top corner, it's a robotic tractor. They put a controller. You can operate this tractor using remote control, like a drone, you know. And also some farmers, they decided to use their excavators they just heavily put some armor on top, and they're using this sort of equipment to demine, because more than 30% of Ukrainian territory is mined, and it's gonna take, I think, decades to demine everything. So, but people want to operate on those land, on that land, so they basically are getting creative and they just do everything possible by themselves.
I'm gonna shut my camera off again so that you can't see me. Anybody have a question they'd like to ask? Romana?
Hopefully, there we go. Switch microphones. And we've got a question out here in the audience. So Roman knows who you are and what you do. Can you start with that, please?
David Jenkins from Springfield, Illinois, raised cattle. You mentioned that you manage the farm ground. Who owns the farm ground in Ukraine?
We are owners of the farm, but most of our land is distributed among a very big number of landlords. So currently we have roughly around 300 landlords, and those are small parcels. I mean, we don't manage facilities, because facilities, we own facilities, but we are not, I don't sit in tractor most of my days. I sit in office and manage everything. I manage people. That's what I mean.
How small are the parcels that you're farming? And they are contiguous. I mean, they're one after another by the way that Ukraine divvied up the land afterwards, right? So they're 20 acres? 10 acres?
No, it's from 5 to 10 acres.
They are all next to each other, so they're same field, but their same field might have, what, 40, 50 different landowners? Okay, that's what I wanted.
Yeah,
we have another question.
Yeah, that's correct.
And how do you pay them?
On yearly basis. At the end of the year, we pay them fixed rate. It's around $100 per acre.
Tom Kale, Bloomington, Illinois, family farm operation. Can you go into any more detail as to when you say the ground is heavily mined, and I'm assuming it's not a pattern, but are there areas where the mines are just side by side and then there's none, or is there, when you say heavily, is that one every 100 square feet or 50 every 100 square feet? Or just varies?
It depends. Sometimes it's just heavily mined, you cannot go and operate. I mean, it's impossible to go there. But on some areas where all of these combines and tractors just were blown up, those areas you can have several mines per field, but still several mines per 100 acres field, it's a big threat. And the odds you are going to touch those mines, they are huge, because you need to till everything. Or if you no till, of course, you can have row crops, and you leave some spaces between rows. So in this case, your odds decreasing, but still, you know, the odds are very, very high.
Ray Brownfield from near Chicago, Illinois. I'm a farm manager and a real estate broker. What method of transportation do you use to get from your facility to the port facilities?
Usually it's railway, but also, right now we are facing some difficulties, and actually last year it was very brutal, because we had a lot of electricity shortages, and using railway it was very hard and very long. So we started to use trucks. It's more expensive, but it's reliable because you know where your truck is, and you know you can track it, and you can plan your exporting pace, and also you can make some projections how much bushels you can export per month and stuff like that. But mainly railway. Right now, railway.
Are you still booking the freight yourself? He told me a story the first time around that you use the elevator, but you use the elevator for the siding, and you book your own. We're booking your own cars. You're booking your own Panamaxes and to the final destination, which was, I think, Sweden. I can't remember at that point. Are you still doing that?
No, not right now, because there are a lot of risks involved. And I need to put a lot of money up front. And we have a lot of limitations on foreign operations. So it's quite hard to being a regular farmer. It's quite hard to do that stuff. And, the Panamax costs a lot. And you need to organize all of the logistics and all of this stuff, all of your farmer partners, because Panamax, it's a lot of grain. So we don't do it right now, but some of my friends who live closer to Danube River or to Odessa ports, they do it. And also, for me, going to that Danube region, it's almost impossible because you need to have you need to obtain a special permit to enter that area, and so it's hard to control this operation. But before war, it was quite easy to use if you have enough knowledge and enough grain to sell. Yeah, you can easily book Panamax and just deliver it to, I don't know, to European Union consumers, or you can, one of the most popular size of vessel, it's coaster. It's around 5 to 8,000 tons. It's quite cheap. And you can deliver it to, let's say, to Italy, to Spain, to Egypt, to, whatever. In the Mediterranean region, it's fast.
Just as a reminder here, Ramon Gorobots farms about 5,500 acres. That's not really very big, certainly not big enough to book your own Panamax, but he and farmers in Ukraine were doing that. Farmers here in the United States would find this unheard of.
So you can, on CIF delivery, in CIF, in Incoterms basis, CIF, yeah. So you can find the consumer, you can make an agreement under GAFTA. It's a special contract. And that's it. Book your vessel, deliver grain, and it works pretty easy, actually.
We are hopeful that you'll be able to do that again soon.
It used to work.
Yeah, we're hopeful that you'll be able to do that again. Thank you, Roman. I know it's 5 o'clock and you have a birthday party to get to. We really appreciate you being here. Give Roman Gorobots a nice round of applause. Thank you so much, Roman. We'll see you later.
Thank you very much for having me here. And it's a great pleasure to speak about myself, about my operations. If I had more time, I would definitely speak more about everything. But thank you very much for such an opportunity. I appreciate it.
We do appreciate it. That's Roman Gorobots. Let's turn our attention, goodbye now, Roman, to Joanna Colusi. Hi, Joanna, how are you? Good morning to you. We can hear you. I will turn things over directly to you now and the floor.
Yeah, just a moment. I'm just...
Okay.
So, good morning, everyone. Thank you all for joining us today. And thanks for having me at this excellent conference. Last year, I was there in person. This year, unfortunately, I'm talking with you from Brazil. But I'm sure that we will share a lot of information. It will be a nice conversation. I will start by providing an update on Brazilian crop and trade prospects. Also, I will talk a little bit about Argentina, which has a new president since Sunday. So I have been in Brazil since last Sunday. To be more precise, I am in Porto Alegre, a city in the south of Brazil, near Argentina and Uruguay. I am around 14 hours from Champagne by plane. And today the temperature here is 99 degrees Fahrenheit. It's really hot. So December is here for most of you. That means the end of the field work for the season. But the south of the equator, peak growing season is underway. Soybean planting is behind schedule in Brazil, which could mean lower global soybean and corn production in the coming months. High temperatures and drought in the center west and wet conditions in the south, where I am, have led to delayed soybean planting. Concerns have arisen for the second crop, corn, because of the planting delays. The impact of El Niño on Brazilian agriculture is becoming increasingly evident. Of course, while it's still early to estimate the potential reduction, there are several market factors that bear watching in the coming weeks that could potentially influence prices and marks in the United States. Gene, could you go the next slide, please? I think it's, thank you so much. So after three consecutive growing seasons under La Niña's influence, this crop season has been very different with El Niño since March of this year. Generally speaking, the effects of El Niño are the opposite of the effects of La Niña for South America. During the growing season under El Niño, northern and central Brazil experience reduced rainfall, while southern Brazil and Argentina see increased rainfall. Dryness has impacted central Brazil at the peak of the planting season, especially in Mato Grosso, while the southern part of Brazil has been too much rain. The NOAA model suggests that El Niño will reach its peak in either late December or early January. Based on the most recent forecast, there is a greater than 55% chance of at least a strong El Niño persisting through January-March 2024, which could result in even larger negative impacts on Brazilian crop production. So the next one, let's see El Niño impacts on the center west so far. Precipitation in October and November in Mato Grosso was 6.4 inches, 53% below the third year average. In addition, November 2023 was the hottest and driest November in 30 years in Mato Grosso. Dry weather and high temperature in the last 2 months have forced the replanting of soybean in at least 5% of the area. And we know that replanting is never the same in terms of yields. That forecast is from the Mato Grosso Institute of Agricultural Economics, but there are other forecasts that they say that the replanting area is around 10%. On the screen, we can see some pictures taken recently in Lucas do Rio Verde and Sorriso in Mato Grosso. In contrast, the next slide, please. Too much rain has slowed planting progress in southern Brazil, where I am now. November was the second wettest in more than 30 years in the state of Rio Grande do Sul. Parts of southern Brazil have experienced flooding since September. These pictures are from some cities in my state, Rio Grande do Sul. The situation has been really bad over the last few months. I arrived here on Sunday, the temperature was very high. But we have seen rain yesterday. Now the weather sounds rain again. So it's a very unusual situation. Next slide. Despite the concern about delays in planting season in Brazil, it's very important to highlight that Brazil is very large, like the United States. And soybean and corn production is spread across different microclimates. So that means losses in some regions are often offset by gains in others regions. So although there is a stress in some of these regions, there are good forecasts for others. I'm trying to get just down here to see some pictures. Sorry, I think I'm. These pictures is in some cities here, and I said, although there is stress in some states like Mato Grosso, there are other regions in very good conditions like this one that you are seeing on the screen. This crops is from the Ferrarim group. I visited this farm last May, Mato Grosso, alongside Professors Nick Bolson and Gary Shinitki. So at the time, we saw, of course, the safrinha on the ground, and now it's the soybeans. So let's move on for the next slide. Now let's take a look at the most recent forecast for soybeans. The National Supply Company, CONAB, Brazil's agents for food supply and statistics, has revised its forecast for the next soybean harvest because of adverse weather in crucial growing regions such as Mato Grosso. Next slide, please. CONAB has reduced its soybean production forecast to 5.8 billion metric tons, down 1.4% from last month's projection. Despite this adjustment, Brazil is still expected to produce a record crop, 3% higher than in 2022-2023 season. However, some analysts are more conservative, projecting Brazil's soybean harvest to could be lower than last year because of the weather in key agricultural regions. Brazilian soybean acreage is expected to grow 3% to 112 million acres. Next one, Brazil's soybean planting progress is nearing completion, but still lags historical average at this point in the season by about 10%. The official national data indicates that as December 9, 90% of the soybean crop is in the ground, compared to 96% at the same time last year. This is the slowest planting pace since 2015-2016. The combination of hot and dry weather has caused significant crop stress, leaving some farmers in Mato Grosso to shift acreage into cotton rather than soybeans. Let's see the next slide, please. Brazilian soybean exports in 2023-2024 are forecast at a record of 102 million tons, a 5% increase from last season's shipments of 97 million tons. The forecast is based on available supplies, favorable exchange rates, and continued robust global demand, especially from China. The last slide about soybeans. Finally, here you can see one slide about soybean production costs in Brazil. Actually, it's a comparison between Illinois and Mato Grosso. We published this article on FarmDocDaily recently. Overall, soybean production costs have been higher in Mato Grosso than central Illinois since 2016. The higher costs is mostly due to the high fertilizer and pesticide costs. This has been driven by currency fluctuations, global market volatility, heavy reliance on fertilizer imports in Brazil, and increasing pest pressures in Mato Grosso, more because of the tropical climate there. In contrast, soybean seed costs have been higher in Illinois than in Mato Grosso. Seed costs in Brazil are lower and tend to experience less volatility than fertilizers and pesticides, as the majority of the seed is grown in Brazil domestically. So now let's move on to corn production and trade prospects. Slow planting progress of the soybean crop in the Central West increases the likelihood of planting delays and further problems for the second corn crop called safrinha. It must be planted within a specific date range, typically from January to beginning of March, to prevent the crop maturing during the dry season, which starts in middle April. More than 70% of the corn today in Brazil is produced as a second corn crop. As you can see on the screen, the current delay in the crop season combined with a smaller acreage has led to a 10% reduction in the corn production forecast compared to the previous season. Total corn production is projected to be 4.6 billion tons according to, bushels. According to the National Supply Company. Because of high production costs and relatively unattractive future prices, total Brazilian corn acreage is expected to decrease by 5% to 52 million acres. Faced with the increase in the risk of growing outside the ideal planting window, maybe farmers could reduce corn acreage even more by January, so they still have time to make this decision. Meanwhile, the next slide, please. The heavy rainfall in the countries south has damaged and delayed the first corn crop. Brazil's first corn planting reached 66% of the planted area as December 9, compared to 77% at the same time last year. Brazil's first crop corn production is expected to decline by 8% in 2023-2024 cycle, and Brazil's second crop corn production is expected to decline by 11%. So if Brazil's soybean planting season continues to run far behind in December, or if El Nino takes a bite out of Brazilian yields, U.S. farmers could benefit from opportunities for their corn and soybeans to be more competitive in exported markets in the beginning of the year in 2024. As you can see on the screen, the United States lost its position as the number one in corn exports to Brazil in 2023. When China opened its market to Brazilian corn, Brazilian soybean exports in 2023 are forecast at a record 52 million tons, a 21% increase from last season's shipments. However, Brazil is expected to reduce its shipments in 2023-24 marketing year. Brazilian corn exports are forecast at 38 million tons. If that happens, Brazil could return the corn export crowd to the United States. It could be a good news, at least for Americans. We will see. The availability of low-cost corn from safrinha in the center-west of Brazil was the main region to attract national and international companies to invest in corn ethanol production in Brazil. In contrast to the United States, most Brazilian ethanol is made from sugarcane. Corn ethanol plants began appearing in the last decade in Brazil, in the last 10 years, I would say. Corn ethanol production jumped from 40 million liters to 4.4 billion liters over the last 10 years, as you can see on the screen. And corn ethanol is expected to account for almost 20% of all ethanol consumed in the country next year. Today is around 14%. Currently, there are 20 ethanol plants in Brazil. The next slide, please, Jim. So there are 20 ethanol plants in Brazil using corn as the feedstock. 9 plants are corn only, while the rest are flax plants producing ethanol from sugarcane and corn. They are able to use the both. Of course, Mato Grosso leads this production. Mato Grosso is the number one in soybean production in Brazil and corn production in Brazil. So the state leads the production, the corn ethanol production, with almost 70% of total corn ethanol planting. So I stop in this slide. About there are 20 ethanol plants in Brazil using corn as a feedstock. 9 plants are corn only, while the rest are flax plants. I think it is the second slide that I will talk about. The Mato Grosso is the number one corn ethanol, followed by Mato Grosso do Sul and Goiás, all of them in the center-west of states. There we go. The next slide again. So the first corn-only ethanol plant in Brazil was built in 2017 by FS Bioenergy. It's a joint venture of Tapajós Participações and Summit Agriculture Group from Iowa in the United States. The company has 2 facilities in the state of Mato Grosso, in the towns of Lucas do Rio Verde and Sorriso. We visited the plant in Lucas do Rio Verde last May with Professor Gary Schnitke and Nick Paulson. So I think I have more 10 minutes. Let's move on to Argentina. We really need more time to talk about Argentina, but I will try to summarize the tricky situation there in a few minutes and save, of course, some time for questions. First, let's start looking at the soybean production forecast for South America. Brazil, Argentina, Paraguay, and Uruguay are expected to increase compared to the last season. The Buenos Aires Grain Exchange forecasts that Argentina's soybean production for 2023-2024 crop year will be almost double than previous crop. Do you remember that last year a historical drought caused by La Niña impacted the production, especially in Argentina and in the south of Brazil? The drought forced the country to import a record number of soybeans from neighbors, Paraguay, Bolivia, and Brazil, to keep its crushing factories open. You know that Argentina is the number one in soybean meal and soybean oil exports. Let's see the cropping progress so far. Argentina's soybean and corn planting reached 55% of the planted area as of the first week of December, on pace with the last year. So despite some challenges with weather conditions in planting areas, we can say that the outlook for the crop season in Argentina so far is really good for corn and soybeans. So after 3 years of a lot of weather problems, finally Argentina sees the chance for a full crop under a new president and economic regulations. Let's talk a little bit about that. Argentina has had a new president since last Sunday. The libertarian economist Javier Milei takes one of the world's toughest economic challenges. You know that the country is a big food exporter and used to be one of the healthiest nations in the developed world, but decades of mismanagement have destroyed the Argentina economy. The annual inflation reached 160% in November, and more than 40% of the population is in poverty condition. And at the root of Argentina's problem is the government chronic overspending. The size of the state has almost doubled over the past two decades. Not by coincidence, on his first day in office, Javier Milei cut the number of Argentina's government ministries in half, from 19 to 8, starting what he has called a shock treatment. Keeping in the line with one of his main campaign promises, Milei signed a decree to cut ministries such as transportation, social development, public works, education, culture, and tourism. Last Tuesday, 2 days after taking off, next slide, please. The new Minister of Economy announced the deep spending cuts and a sharp devaluation of Argentina's currency, bringing the government exchange rate much closer to the market value of the peso. I don't know if you're familiar, but before that, there were at least 15 different kinds of pesos. So there was the official peso, but there was, they call, unofficial peso that was over 1,000 pesos for $1. It was crazy. Milei's government also will stop new infrastructure projects, lay off recently hired government workers, and reduce energy and transportation subsidies for residents. About the retención, is the export taxes, it's unlikely that the ag sector, the agriculture sector, will see a reduction or removal of export taxes during at least the first year. The export taxes is one of the Argentinian farmers' primary concerns, but I would say that the possibility to remove that could be in 1 year, 2 years, not less than that, because this is a special revenue for Argentina government. So in his first address as a president last Sunday, Milei said that in the short term, the situation will worsen, but then the Argentinians will see the fruits of their efforts. So we will have to stay tuned to see what's happened in Argentina. So far, that's all for me, Todd. Thank you so much for your attention. I will be very happy to take any questions you may have.
Joanna Colucci is a member of the FarmDoc team, agricultural economist. She presented during the Farm Assets Conference remotely as she was in Brazil. Our first presenter during this program was Roman Gorobots. He is a farmer located in Ukraine. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world, online at willag.org. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason.